Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. And later in the programme, Rwandan-backed rebels have entered and taken control of a second city in the eastern region of the Democratic Republic of Congo. We hear from a local resident who was there as they moved into the city earlier on today.
We have been aware of the coming of the rebels early this morning because when they entered the city, they have held their first meeting at the Independence Place down in Bukavu City, and this has really officially announced their presence in the town.
Also, the awards ceremony for the annual British Film Awards has just ended. We hope to be hearing from some of the winners. It was only last Wednesday that President Trump spoke to President Putin on the phone about his plan to end the war in Ukraine. And already US and Russian negotiators are planning to meet for discussions in Saudi Arabia next week and maybe prepare for a possible summit between their two presidents. The speed with which these contacts are proceeding, along with elements of the plan, Russia keeping much of the territory it's occupied and Ukraine blocked from joining NATO, blindsided European leaders at the recently ended Munich Security Conference, the more so because Europe and Ukraine are, for the moment, excluded from the negotiations. And for the moment, those leaders must content themselves with a meeting in Paris on Monday to discuss Ukraine and security. But the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who will be attending the Saudi talks, has been downplaying expectations of a breakthrough.
It will not be easy to end a conflict like this. And there are other parties at stake that have opinions on this as well. The European Union has sanctions as well. The Ukrainians are obviously fighting this war. It's their country and they're on the front lines. So one meeting isn't going to solve it. But I want to reiterate, the president made clear he wants to end this war. And if opportunities present themselves to further that, we're going to take them if they present themselves. We'll see what happens over the next few days.
Well, let's speak to the BBC's Tom Bateman, who's traveling with Marco Rubio. He's on the line from Jerusalem. And Tom, any more details of when these Saudi talks will take place and who will attend?
Well, we know who will attend in terms of the American delegation. That will be Marco Rubio, who you've just heard from there, the Secretary of State, Mr. Trump's National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz, and then Steve Witkoff, who until now had been his Middle East envoy, but has expanded his brief under Mr. Trump's direction, it seems, to the Ukraine and Russia file as well. In terms of when, that is still not clear. Now, Marco Rubio had always been flying onto Riyadh from Jerusalem on Monday. That had always been the schedule, expected to meet the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, and other senior figures. It is not clear to me that the Russian meetings will take place tomorrow, although it is not impossible. Perhaps it will be a bit later in the week. And you heard that Mr. Rubio himself there seemed pretty vague on the exact timeline. But then I think the significance is about the fundamental reset in relations between the US and Russia that we have seen in the course of this extraordinary 2 days at the Munich Security Conference, embodied in the 90-minute phone call between Mr. Trump and President Putin that took place during the week. That was then followed up on Saturday night with a phone call between Secretary of State Rubio and his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, of which the Russians put out a statement afterwards in almost sort of glowing terms, saying that the US had instigated the call and suggesting, or at least their claim was, that the Americans had spoken to them about effectively removing part of Russia's isolation. This would be removing sanctions, doing trade once again with Russia. So I think we are witnessing, you know, an extraordinary turnaround in terms of the way that Washington is viewing its future relationship with Moscow and with President Putin, to the horror really of some in Europe and to the significant anxiety, I think, of the Ukrainians who won't be involved in these talks in Saudi Arabia.
I mean, there's been widespread criticism of what are perceived to be concessions being made to Russia even before these talks begin, and President Trump even accused of appeasement. Do we have any indication of what the United States is expecting of Russia?
Well, I think the first point is that what we saw from the administration in Munich was particularly voice from Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary, who appeared to lay down really a series of concessions that the Americans would expect Ukraine to make without similarly articulating those that they would expect the Russians to make as well. So there was concern about that. As for the administration, Mr. Hegseth in particular, I mean, they adamantly deny that this was laying down concessions. They call this realism. And I think Mr. Trump's ambition is to be seen as the deal maker, the peacemaker in Ukraine. I think where the challenge comes with that, and to sort of answer your question, is that the two fundamental areas where Ukraine believes that if it went ahead with these possible concessions, it would be nothing short of capitulation, is on the occupation of its sovereign territory, of which Russia holds about a fifth. And now, it was the last head of NATO who described in the State Department actually last year that, in their words, they didn't see occupation as peace, in that if you didn't solve at least part of the problem over territory, you wouldn't have a long-lasting and, as Ukraine would see it, just peace. So that is one of the key areas. The other, of course, is about NATO membership. The Ukrainians want a security guarantee, and it's very hard to see how the Americans can bridge that gap with what Vladimir Putin wants.
Tom, many thanks. That was the BBC's Tom Bateman, who's travelling with Marco Rubio. Well, Ukraine's neighbour Poland has been one of its staunchest backers, and its foreign minister Radek Sikorski has called President Trump's telephone conversation with President Putin a mistake. He was at the just-ended Munich Security Conference, where he had talks with the US Special Envoy to Ukraine, General Keith Kellogg, following which he described the US negotiating strategy he'd been presented with as unorthodox. I asked Mr. Sikorski what he meant by that.
I don't want to go into details for understandable reasons, but we do hope that the US succeeds in bringing a fair peace to Ukraine, because this is vital to the security interests of, above all, Ukraine, but also Poland and all of Europe.
So those tactics are not as simplistic as allowing Russia to block Ukraine's access to NATO and indeed allowing Russia to hang on to the land that it seized in Ukraine.
There are other elements, yes.
Such as?
You will have to ask General Kellogg.
But enough for you not to be alarmed about what the United States is preparing to do.
Well, the US is a military superpower. The US supplied almost as much aid to Ukraine as Europe has. And if President Trump wants to try his hand, we should certainly wish him luck.
I mean, try his hand. You seem a bit more relaxed than some of your European colleagues, who are extraordinarily put out at the idea that they're excluded from any negotiations about the future of Ukraine.
Well, this is primarily about Ukraine, and I don't think a peace agreement can be achieved without Ukraine's participation. That's what we should be mainly focused on. Look, the US has a point when they say that those multilateral negotiations of Minsk 1, Minsk 2 did not exactly produce a coherent or lasting result.
But Europe has been arming Ukraine. It's been imposing sanctions on Russia. Surely it deserves some sort of seat at the table.
I believe we'll get it in due course, because I don't think anything that can stick can be agreed without Europe. After all, it's through Europe that the logistical lines go. Ukraine is dependent on American arms, but equally dependent on European financing. And remember, we hold the bulk of frozen Russian assets.
Because it's been suggested that whereas Europe might not be physically present at the negotiating table, your views will be taken into account. Is that good enough for you?
By the fruits you shall judge them.
You're being very cryptic, Mr. Sikorski, and perhaps understandably, given the sensitivity of where we are at the moment. But can I possibly have your thoughts on a European security force that might be deployed in Ukraine to keep the peace once some sort of deal is done?
This wasn't a Polish idea, and remember, Poland's first duty to NATO is to protect the eastern flank, which is Poland's own territory, which is affected by this war. You know, we have Russian drones and cruise missiles flowing through our airspace. This was initially President Macron's idea. There are other ideas of, for example, helping Ukraine remotely in the air, and other creative ideas. I think they should all be considered.
Because Poland, along with other European countries, was last week sent a diplomatic demarche by the United States, in which you were asked whether you would be willing to deploy troops to Ukraine as part of a peace settlement and what the size of any European-led force might be. Have you answered that?
Yes, we have, but it's non-public.
Even in general terms, were you positive, your reaction?
I don't think we need to inform Putin about all of our intentions.
Do you feel that Russia should cede the territory that it has seized in Ukraine?
Well, Russia thinks so. Remember, Russia gave Ukraine security guarantees of inviolability of borders in the Budapest Memorandum of 1993. And also the two countries have a border treaty of 2004, negotiated, signed and ratified by President Putin.
So we must invoke Budapest going forward.
And the bilateral treaty. Otherwise, we are in danger of saying that Russia broke the previous treaty, but surely it'll respect the next one.
And what about Ukraine's accession to NATO? Do you feel that is still viable?
That's something that people can change their minds about. Remember, at Bucharest in 2008, I was there, the United States was in favor. Germany and France blocked it. Henry Kissinger was against before the war, but once the war broke out, he actually managed to, before he passed away, to back the idea.
Will you be sharing with your colleagues the contents of your conversation with General Kellogg?
Well, of course, we are a competent government. We share notes of our important meetings within our cabinet, just like you do.
I was just wondering whether you thought it might be a good idea for Europe to appoint an envoy to Ukraine.
We have one. She's called High Representative for Foreign and Security Policy, Kaja Kallas, and she's forthright and competent about it.
That was Poland's Foreign Minister Radek Sikorski. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. And we go now to the Democratic Republic of Congo, to the mineral-rich east of the country, where rebels backed by neighbouring country Rwanda and known as M23 have captured two major cities in as many months. In January, it was Goma, capital of North Kivu province, and now they've taken control of Bukavu, capital of South Kivu province. Video footage showed people celebrating as a group of M23 rebels drove along a street in Bukavu. The rebels have ignored international calls for a ceasefire amidst concerns that the insurgency could trigger a broader regional conflict. Government troops in Bukavu put up minimal resistance. The authorities in Kinshasa have previously accused Rwanda of wanting to gain access to and mine the minerals in the east. I've been speaking to a resident of Bukavu. When did you first become aware of the M23's presence in the city?
We have been aware of the coming of the rebels early this morning because when they entered the city, they have held their first meeting at the Independence Place down in Bukavu City, and this has really officially announced their presence in the town.
And would you say that they now control the whole of Bukavu, or is there maybe still some resistance from government troops?
There is no resistance from the national army. There is no resistance because when they came to the city, the ground was somehow empty and they could really move around the city the way they could, as much as they could.
Were people pleased to see them? I mean, we've heard cheering by some residents?
Oh, of course. The people, the civilians down in Bukavu, some of them are really happy with their presence because the time they came, they have been warmly welcomed. Let me say that before their presence in the city, there was some kind of vandalism because shops, stores here have been vandalized, especially the World Food Program shop.
So you say that there was looting before the rebels arrived, as people thought they were coming into the city. And is that still going on, the looting, the vandalism?
So far, there is no longer looting. There is no longer vandalism because when the rebels entered, they have tried to maintain the security. And for the moment, people are now relaxing and there is some kind of security down the city.
So how would you describe the mood now in Bukavu?
In case you happen to resist to obey their laws, people are being killed down in Goma. We don't know if the same case won't be produced down in Bukavu. So we are still waiting to see what will happen later.
As well as government troops, there were troops from Burundi helping to defend Bukavu. Have those Burundian troops gone away now?
All the troops from both countries, I mean the Burundian and the DRC troops, all of them have fled away. There is some kind of betrayal in the DRC army. That's why, as a citizen, as a resident from Bukavu, that's to the DRC government to reshuffle all the national army because there are so many betrayals. All of us over here feel bound by the government.
Betrayals. Do you mean by that deserters, soldiers who ran away?
It is a pity to see people run away. That's the case for our army. For the moment, there is no way to move out to shops because all the shops, all the stores, all the markets, all the supermarkets are closed. Bandits are still on the streets, though the rebels are in the city. Some bandits are still hidden in the streets.
Who are these bandits you speak about?
They are gunmen. We don't know where they came from. Civilians who have picked up guns which have been left by the government soldiers. Others try to speak that these are people who benefited from the prison break because before the rebels came to Bukavu, there was a prison break. And people are trying to say that probably these people who came from the prison break are the ones taking their guns to threaten the citizens.
That was a resident of Bukavu in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo, now under rebel control. Now, how do those opposed to President Putin and the autocratic president of neighbouring Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, feel about President Trump's willingness to directly negotiate with Mr. Putin over Ukraine? The previous US administration had condemned Mr. Lukashenko's repression and provided millions of dollars to support democracy in Belarus. But President Trump has suspended that aid. So is the Belarusian opposition worried about ongoing US support? As Svetlana Tikhanovskaya is their exiled leader.
We, as Democratic Forces of Belarus, fully understand that Belarusian topic should be on the table. And we should look at Belarus as part of a solution, not as a part of the problem. But on the other hand, we are very concerned about cut of assistance to Belarusian opposition because, first of all, our media have been supported by American assistance. And this critical moment when our media have to counter Russian propaganda, Russian narratives in our region, we really hope that there will be a waiver for Belarusian Democratic Forces, for Belarusian resistance, because we serve to the interests of democracy and American leadership.
I mean, are you not disturbed by Mr. Trump's willingness to sit down, as he possibly will, with Vladimir Putin? Mr. Putin first, maybe next Mr. Lukashenko.
I don't think that President Trump will sit with Lukashenko because Lukashenko is not legitimate leader, you know, who seized power in Belarus.
I mean, a lot of people would argue that President Putin isn't a legitimate president either.
Look, the context of Russia and Belarus differs because in Belarusian society there is majority who see that Lukashenko lost elections back in 2020 and we have proofs that he lost, so he's illegitimate. But as for Russia, we still see that he become out of people supporting him and his policy. In Belarus, people are united around pro-European way of development and anti-Lukashenko.
I understand that a senior US official met President Lukashenko on Saturday. Does that concern you in any way?
So we, for a long time, you know, having communication with the American administration about release of political prisoners. And I'm grateful to new Trump's administration that they managed to release three people from prisons, one American citizen and two Belarusian political prisoners. And we are continuing to act in coordination. We'll continue this dialogue maybe about releasing of people. But what's important that for this dialogue, there are preconditions, stop repressions and releasing the rest of the people. So I want to believe that the USA will stay consistent regarding Belarus, pressure on the regime and support of people and demands release all from Belarusian prisons.
Looking forward, though, are you worried that Mr. Putin might now try to tighten his grip on Belarus?
Of course, you know, Putin wants to return Belarus into sphere of influence of Russia. And actually, while Lukashenko is in our country, he's succeeding because with the help of Lukashenko, we see the process of Russification in Belarus. We see how they interfere into our economy, media, education, you know, and they deploy nuclear weapon in our country, holding different military drills, pushing migrants, you know, on the borders. So, of course, they don't want Belarus to return to European family of countries.
That was Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, the exiled leader of Belarus's opposition, who addressed the Munich Security Conference earlier on today. Welcome back to NewsHour. For a moment, or rather for the moment, the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas is largely holding, and with it, the exchange of hostages being held in Gaza and Palestinians imprisoned in Israeli jails. There's clearly relief on both sides, but also revulsion in Israel and elsewhere at the way in which Hamas has orchestrated the hostage releases for propaganda purposes. The International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC, has played a central role in the exchanges. So what's their assessment of how it's gone so far? Sarah Davies is the ICRC's spokesperson currently in Jerusalem.
We have called for dignity and privacy for both types of release and transfer, for both hostages and detainees. Of course, we know that family members are very, very excited and emotionally overwhelmed for both transfers, that they will be meeting their loved ones again, but they are vulnerable. They are coming out of either captivity as a hostage or places of detention. The International Committee of the Red Cross, we haven't had access to either hostages or detainees, unfortunately, and this is something that we continue to call for. So we don't know what condition they are in.
The television pictures that one sees of the hostage releases certainly has the white vehicles of the Red Cross with the Red Cross on them, just waiting there for the hostages to be delivered. But your role is not that passive, is it? There's a lot more to it.
Absolutely. The fact that we can do these operations, it takes days and weeks and really years of preparation. Our neutrality, the reason that we are the ones able to do this, it underpins a lot of the work that we do. We are trusted by both parties. For these specific releases, there are very intense briefings. There are preparations. We map out different paths. We have logistical and transportation details. We have medical staff and weapons contamination specialists on board. You know, we have colleagues that are in regular contact with the parties to this conflict, as well as the mediators during this. And our neutrality is really a critical component to carrying out this work safely.
So you would dismiss the kind of criticism that has come from some in Israel, that the Red Cross is nothing more than a glorified taxi service in this exchange process.
We understand that people are frustrated with what they see, but this is very much a misunderstanding of the role that we play, of the work that we do, and of that direct discussions that we have with the parties.
Of course, these exchanges of prisoners and hostages are part of a broader ceasefire agreement, and I was wondering how that had to date improved the humanitarian situation in Gaza?
I was in Gaza last week and I spoke to people there. There is a very real sense of relief from people because they are not living through active hostilities. But the humanitarian situation, unfortunately, does still remain catastrophic.
That was Sarah Davies from the International Committee of the Red Cross, speaking from Jerusalem. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall. Hollywood came to London today for the 78th British Academy Film Awards. A star-studded cast gathered at the Royal Festival Hall in the centre of the city to hear who'd won what at a ceremony which this year comes between the Golden Globes and the Oscars. And before we give you the results in full, let's hear some brief moments from all five of the Best Film nominees.
If you go with Snowflake Storm.
For anyone who's going to hold your attention on stage, you have to kind of be a freak.
Yeah, you can be beautiful, you can be ugly, but you can't be plain.
Tell me, why is an accomplished foreign architect shoveling coal here in Philadelphia?
I'm afraid it is not so simple.
This is a conclave, Aldo. It's not a war.
It is a war. And you have to commit to a side.
I got a kid who wants someone who speaks Russian.
My Russian is terrible. I can't even roll my R's.
No.
And those were in order trailers from the films A Complete Unknown, The Brutalist, Conclave, Venora and Emilia Perez. Joining us now, our arts and entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson. Colin.
It's the after party that has just started now, and one of the films everyone is talking about is Conclave, because the papal thriller, not a phrase you get to say too often, has done the double tonight. It has won Best Film and it has won Outstanding British Film. Only the fourth film in more than 30 years to achieve that feat. The previous one to do that was Sam Mendes's 1917, which tellingly didn't go on to then win at the Oscars. But for people who haven't seen it, it's about scheming cardinals voting for who is going to be the next Pope. Ralph Fiennes was nominated for Best Actor. He didn't win tonight, actually. Adrian Brody from The Brutalist pipped him to that, but it was a great night for Conclave. Here is one of its moments of triumph.
The BAFTA goes to Conclave.
Thank you so very much. We are deeply humbled. Thank you, Ralph and Isabella. You are... What you did to me on set was, when I watched you, was pure magic. It was beyond my grasp or understanding. So thank you for letting us stand on your shoulders. We would never be here without you.
And that was the director of Conclave, Edward Berger. And Colin, any unexpected winners or losers tonight?
Yeah, interesting, actually. Edward Berger won Best Picture just 2 years ago at the BAFTAs for All Quiet on the Western Front. So this German director, BAFTA, absolutely love him. And it counts as a British film because the likes of Ralph Fiennes being a star, Tessa Ross, the producer, is very British. So that's why it counted for British. Surprises you're talking about. The big one off the night was when it came to Best Actress. Everyone thought it was going to be the procession that has been happening all awards season, with Demi Moore finally at the age of 62 sweeping the awards season board. But no, she was pipped by the 25-year-old Mikey Madison for the film Anora. It is a Cinderella sex worker story about someone who works in a strip club in New York who falls in love with the son of a Russian oligarch. And it is a
congratulations, BAFTA winner.
Yes,
when they read
so.
Out your name, just talk us through what you felt.
Oh, I was not expecting it, not even a little bit. So very, very shocked. Very surreal, I think. I don't know if it'll quite set in until, I don't know when, but no, it's so humbling.
What is it about this film, Anora, that's connecting with people?
You know, our incredible director, Sean Baker, he just tells really interesting stories about humanity and human nature. And, you know, the communities and the people that he centers his film around are ones that often don't get to have films written about them.
At the end of your speech, you dedicated it to sex workers. Why?
Because, I have been able to, you know, meet some of that community through my research of the film, and that's been one of the most incredible parts of making the film, is just getting to know and fall in love with this incredible community of people who deserve respect and don't often get it, I think. And so I just, you know, my character is a sex worker, and I really wanted to accurately portray that community and do them justice, and even if it's just from one person's perspective.
And that was BAFTA Best Actress winner Mikey Madison. And Colin, what do the BAFTAs tell us about who might win or lose in the Oscars in a couple of weeks?
It's an interesting one, Julian, because only twice in the last decade has what's won Best Film at the BAFTAs gone on to repeat at the Oscars. But then you get years like last year where there's 19 overlapping categories and 18 of the winners at the BAFTAs repeated at the Oscars. So some year it's almost identical, other years it's completely different. And this has been a crazy award show. And tellingly tonight, different films won across the board. There were two awards for Wicked, costume and production. There were two awards for Real Pain, which won supporting actor for Kieran Culkin in screenplay. And so it went on. The Brutalist won four, Conclave won four. This is an open Oscar season, and we will not know who is Best Picture until the final moments when the Oscar envelope is opened 2 weeks tonight.
Colin, look, many thanks for that. A very enthused Colin Patterson, our arts and entertainment correspondent. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. You're listening to NewsHour, coming to you live from the BBC in London. A South African religious leader considered to have been the first openly gay imam has been shot dead. Imam Muhsin Hendricks was ambushed in the Eastern Cape on Saturday. He ran a mosque in Cape Town intended as a refuge for gay Muslims. The Reverend Tony Kruger Ayabazibwe was a close friend. She's Executive Global Director of the Global Interfaith Network, a network of LGBT people of faith.
I was devastated. I mean, it's really so sad, but also just so disastrous, because Muhsin had such a massive impact on so many people around the world and on us. I mean, he was one of the founding members of the Global Interfaith Network. So it's just, I mean, it's terribly sad, but it's also a terrible blow to the work for inclusive faith.
And was he openly gay all his adult life?
So I believe that he came out when he was 29.
And was that before he became an imam?
No, it was after he became an imam.
And what was the reaction of other Muslims in South Africa to that?
I am not necessarily in a position to speak to this in great detail, but I understand that there was significant conflict about it, and that I don't know exactly how this works in Muslim tradition, but from what I understand, they kicked him out of the faith community.
But nonetheless, he continued to champion an all-inclusive, compassion-centered Islam.
Yes, he did. He was a visionary and a beacon of hope.
And someone who created safe spaces for queer Muslims.
Yes, very much so. And who was very intent on supporting others to find ways of integrating their spirituality, sexuality and gender, and on sharing the understanding that he had gained through his own struggle, but also through his studies with other queer Muslims.
I mean, he's was thought to be the world's first openly gay imam, but there are now others, are there not, worldwide?
I know of about five or six others, one in Canada, one in the US, one in Berlin, one in Indonesia, one in France. But Muhsin, as far as I understand it, was the first. And also, as you can tell, the only one based in the Global South, which I think is important because the constellations around the intersections of faith and tradition and gender and sexuality here are in some ways significantly different.
Meaning?
Well, so I think that in many Global South contexts, people are significantly more attached to their faith traditions and therefore sometimes less open to a purely human rights narrative. And it's difficult. And this is also why we exist as the Global Interfaith Network.
I mean, had he spoken to you in any way about the possibility that he was leading a dangerous existence as an openly gay imam?
Well, he hadn't spoken to me directly about it, but I think we all knew it, you know? I mean, it's not very safe being a queer religious leader in many contexts, but I think that particularly being a queer Muslim religious leader is particularly dangerous.
I mean, obviously the police, you know, aren't saying a thing at this particular point, but the speculation must be that this was some sort of hate crime.
Yes, I think we are all speculating about that, but we are trying very hard not to say anything because we just don't know. At this point, we're waiting to hear.
How will you remember Imam Muhsin Hendricks?
He was such a gentle man and such an important man. There are so many queer Muslims that I know around the world who are devastated, who are grieving because Muhsin, for them, was such a role model, a beacon of hope, a sign that there was the possibility of bringing together who one is and who one loves with a faith to which many queer Muslims are deeply committed. So I'm really going to miss Muhsin. He was a lovely, lovely man. So important in our work.
That was the Reverend Tony Kruger Ayeba Zibwe from the Global Interfaith Network. It's nearly 3 years since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, hundreds of thousands of lives lost, both military and civilian, and widespread destruction across the country of homes, of schools, of power plants, leaving people without light and heat in the depths of winter. And war-weary Ukrainians crave an end to the conflict. But are they prepared for a peace as envisaged at the moment by the United States and Russia, one in which Russia keeps the territory it seized and Ukraine is blocked from joining NATO? And what's more, negotiations to end the conflict from which Ukraine and its European allies are excluded. Let's hear from Mykolaiv in southern Ukraine, where overnight Russian drone strikes damaged a thermal power plant. Vitaly Kim is the regional governor of Mykolaiv.
Damage occurred on critical infrastructure objects that was heating plant that was heating about one third of the city. 46,000 urban houses without the heating now. Talking about damage, it's happening almost every day. And there was damaged city buildings, it was private buildings, shops, coffee shops, and many others just yesterday.
So these Russian strikes on Mykolaiv are a common occurrence, are they?
Yeah. And for the last 3 days, it was 9 yesterday, more than 20 the day before yesterday, and 7 2 days before. But our military forces, they destroyed the majority of them.
I mean, you say that tens of thousands of people have been left without heating. What's the temperature in Mykolaiv at the moment?
For now, it's approximately -3.
So very, very cold.
Yes, it's snowy. We have snow and minus temperature.
So after nearly 3 years of war, the people of Mykolaiv and indeed the people of Ukraine would really like to see an end to this conflict.
It's not after 3 years. It is from the first day we would like to end this war, from the 24th of February 2022. Nobody likes the war.
US and Russian negotiators are meeting next week in Saudi Arabia to take forward this plan of President Trump. And Ukraine is excluded from the negotiations, as are Ukraine's European backers. And what they've been talking about is Russia holding on to the territory that it's occupied in Ukraine as a way of ending the war.
As far as I'm concerned, well, Mr. Zelensky and Mr. Trump discussed the position of Ukraine. And I cannot discuss with you the situation about Ukraine. I'm involved only and in charge of Mykolaiv region. So this is international policy. So my opinion doesn't matter.
Okay. Your opinion doesn't matter, you say, but you must have a view on how this war should be ended.
This war should be ended by victory of Ukraine, because we are defending our freedom.
So victory for Ukraine means driving the Russians out of Ukraine.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
And do you think Ukraine should join NATO? Would that be a guarantee of your security?
It will help Ukraine to be more powerful and to get more security, because for now, Ukrainian soldiers are one of the best in NATO. But still, we do not have enough weapon and ammunition, but we have experience and will.
But you trust your government to do the best for your country?
I work for my president, so all the decision make my president doing, I'm realizing it in the region. I'm on my job. Policy and diplomatic, this is not my work.
Vitaly Kim, the regional governor of Mykolaiv in Ukraine. It's been a year since the death of the Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny in an Arctic penal colony, and the anniversary is being marked around the globe, and also in Moscow, where the threat of security clampdowns remain. His wife, Yulia Navalnaya, spoke from outside Russia and paid tribute to those who travelled to the cemetery in Russia's capital where Mr. Navalny is buried.
I'm grateful to everyone who remembers Alexei, who talks about him, writes about him, who comes to the cemetery. I'm grateful to those who've been supporting me this year. Your letters, your hugs. This is what stops me from forgetting why Alexei did this and why I'm doing this. Even now, a year after his death, Putin is trying to erase Alexei's name from our memory, to hide the truth about his murder, but he will not succeed.
And this report from our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford on Alexei Navalny's legacy.
He was, for many years, the only real opposition leader, the only real challenge to Vladimir Putin within Russia. And for that, he was persecuted, pursued, imprisoned, poisoned. He was a man who paid a huge price, as Olaf Scholz, the German Chancellor, has mentioned, for his opposition to Vladimir Putin. And he was a man who started out life, he's a lawyer, he started out as an anti-corruption campaigner. And that was a cause, I think, which helped him to really rally people behind him, and particularly young Russians. Alexei Navalny used social media very, very effectively and very widely. He was extremely charismatic. He could rally crowds. He was actually, for a long time, in a very repressive political regime. He was the one person who could bring people out onto the streets in protest against Vladimir Putin. And that is why in 2020, he was poisoned with a Novichok nerve agent. But when he recovered, he was treated abroad in Germany. When he recovered, he went back to Russia and he was imprisoned immediately at the airport and never walked free from prison. So he died a year ago. And today, around the world, from Australia to Argentina, there are people, his supporters, people who believed in what he stood for, who are coming to remember him and to remember what he stood for. you know, the Russian opposition forces are even more beleaguered and even more depressed and lost, frankly, than ever before. Alexei Navalny was the last kind of remaining opposition leader. Without him, I think many people feel quite bereft. Of course, since the start of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine 3 years ago, many, many opposition supporters, those who used to speak out, have fled the country because opposition has been criminalized inside Russia itself. So many people, including even Alexei Navalny's lawyers, have been locked up, accused of extremism. So it is an incredibly difficult environment in which to be openly in opposition to Vladimir Putin and what he stands for. And I think, you know, whilst some Russian opposition supporters had hoped that perhaps Vladimir Putin would be defeated in Ukraine and then there might be a chance for change in Russia, of course, now that looks a very remote possibility.
That was the BBC's Sarah Rainsford ending this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.